Clemens has been a friend of mine and a teacher for the last 10 years. I met him in Arizona when we had just moved out from New York City, and I started to study with him then. He's a psychologist and the editor of the Journal of Time, Space, and Knowledge. Larry has been, for the last 14 years, the primary colleague and friend of a Tibetan reincarnate lama who came from Tibet with his manuscripts and his reestablishing a tradition that could not continue under the Chinese there. So Larry has spent this time in an intense exploration of the spiritual heritage. He has also developed a course which took a year that he taught in California on time, space, and knowledge at Berkeley and at Stanford, and associated with several professors, and then held a seminar at Berkeley, which I attended, that brought together the top nuclear physicists of the world from England, from Jerusalem, from America. People were doing research on the brain as a hologram, writers like the writers of the Tao of Physics and the Dancing Wuli Masters, to explore the kinds of creative thought and new dimensions that were being discovered in the new physics, the subatomic levels, and the points of congruence or conflict between that and the world of time, space, and knowledge as perceived by the Tibetans. So Larry is very skilled at finding ways of communicating across cultural and knowledge lines. Do I need to say? I think that probably gives you a sense of who he is. It's a pleasure to introduce Larry Simmons.
Thank you, Annette. And that reminds me that I should tell you I'm a Mormon, too. This afternoon, I feel like someone who's bringing a very old gift to new friends. Tibet's a word that calls to mind images of the high Himalayas, snow-covered and remote, with wild mountain streams and rivers, red-robed monks, incense, ancient petroglyphs, inaccessible colorful buildings, prayer flags, prayer wheels, a great theocracy, a culture that saw in every manifestation spirit, a people rosy-cheeked, clear-eyed, capable of extraordinary physical exertion, cheerful but deeply devoted. And in this setting, white-robed yogis and yoginis, wise men and women, reputed to have paranormal powers and virtues, Tibet provides a natural setting of awe, mystery, and wonderment. And it is in Tibet that a tradition started and flourished, the Vajrayana, or the Diamond Path. And the oldest and most faithful to ancient traditions is the Nyingmapa. It is the Nyingmapas that have kept a living tradition of the Terma, Terton, up and into the 20th century. The Nyingmapa reveres their founder, the Tibetan prophet saint, Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava's name means lotus-born. His birth was foretold by the Buddha when the Buddha was about to pass into final nirvana. He addressed his disciples prophesying, "I am passing away into parinirvana. O monks, do not grieve. In the northwest of the land Odiyan, there is an immaculately pure lake called Dhanaskosha. 8 years after me, in the midst of the lake, there will appear a miraculous lotus, and from the center of the blossom will come forth one who is greater than I. He is known as Padmasambhava, the lotus born, and he will be the teacher of my esoteric mantra doctrine and shall deliver all beings from misery." The king of Odiyan, Indra Budhi, discovered in this pure lake a matchless lotus, and upon its petals an 8-year-old boy endowed with virtues. It is said that he appeared as an ordinary young monk. However, he had been ordained by the patriarch Ananda. He practiced diligently all the sacred mantras and esoteric meditations. He mastered the sciences, philosophy, logic, and grammar of the day. He won dominion over the wild and restless forces of the cosmos. He preached and performed many miracles. He established monasteries and then visited other parts of the world. While practicing meditation in a cave in Nepal, he overcame the demonic forces and won the highest perfection. The king of Tibet invited Padmasambhava to Tibet. He arrived about 747 A.D. He remained many years among the Tibetan people and instructed them according to their capacity to learn. Recognizing that mankind was not yet ready to receive many of the highest teachings, he composed many sacred concealed teachings called Dharma. He charged the Kinis with the care of these Dharma until future times. He hid them away into various parts of the earth. The Dakinis, female spiritual beings, actively assisted in the discovery of the secret sacred writings. They are often in the mysterious Dakini language, which only the Tirthan or Terma master understands. Padmasambhava gave many prophecies regarding future times in which Terma masters would recover these precious treasures. His 25 disciples pledged to return in order to facilitate the salvation of later generations. When he had at last completed his work, he took leave of Tibet and its people. It is said that he now resides in a holy copper-colored mountain, and his splendor is greater than the light of 1,000 suns, that his deeds of compassion are swifter than lightning, his intentions are as deep as the vastness of space, and through compassion towards all beings, he accomplishes the good of the universe. As with many ancient great ones, the story of his life is a tapestry woven of myth and history. Padmasambhava is said to be the founder of the Diamond Path, and the oldest school is the Nyingmapa. The Vajrayana has many facets, but the one I wish to relate to this afternoon is the Nyingmapa because of its unique Terma Tirthan tradition. The Nyingma tradition has two branches. The first branch is called the Old Transmission. It translates as the Pronouncements, which deals with the teachings of the mystics of the past, that means before the 9th century. The first branch, Kuntu Wangpo, is established in terms of the primary wisdom of noetic being and is unchanged and eternal. It teaches the pronouncements. The pronouncements loosely translate as logos. So the old transmission was considered the source of logos. I'd like to come back if we have enough time and review that and look for some affinities between John the Beloved and the logos ideas that he presented in this tradition. The other branch is the new transmission of the concealed teachings, Terma, given by Padmasambhava or other great beings and later unearthed by a religiously predestined person or the Tirthan. This new transmission can be called the direct one. The inspiration of the past meets immediately the discoverer of the concealed teachings. He gets a view of the concealed teachings. By the way, the Terma means treasure or precious. Ter means objects of treasure, like jewels or gold. And also, the word itself translates as aspiration for liberation, and also means the hidden meanings of words. Terma designates specifically texts of religious content concealed by a master, in most cases Padmasambhava, and later brought to light by the religiously predestined person. The discovered Terma is called Tirthan. The Tirthan is the discoverer, and many times the editor of the concealed treasures, the fragments that have been unearthed. The appearance of such a discoverer is announced in a prophecy almost always, or a terlum. In most cases, these prophecies are taken from the 92nd chapter of Padmasambhava's life. Because of the religious charisma of the discoverer, the Tirthan gets noetic or spiritual instruction or keys. The primary treasure concealed was usually books, but also relics and objects are included in the Terma tradition. As sometimes things are, or keys are given noetically during meditation, there's also a classification called the Gontar. Also, the Terma can be related, in most cases, to the interaction with spiritual beings, representatives of the transcendent, so as to ensure their transmission. When the books are rediscovered, spiritual beings merely return them to their discoverer. This tradition and transmission takes place as noetic events. This Vajrayana Terma tradition produced more than 49 authenticated tirthans since the 9th century. When I say 49, there were a number more than that, but the 49 had also the qualities of being confirmed by deed and community, and also confirmed by prophecy beforehand. This great teaching is practically unknown in the West and almost unheard of by LDS members. However, it bears many, many similarities. The teaching were usually sacred books. That's the first thing. Two is they were hidden in stone repositories. The second thing. Third was that they were many times recorded on gold plates. Fourth, the tirthan was prophesied or foretold. Fifth, the tirthan was visited by spiritual beings or angels. Sixth, the tirthan was instructed, guided, led to the concealed teachings. The tirthan was given endowments, initiations, keys, and hints, and the tirthan was tested. Usually the tirthan became what the Tibetans call a sprulpa, an authentic being, a prophet or a saint, the link between the noetic world and the phenomenal world of appearance. I'd like to give an example of a contemporary of Joseph Smith, Jamyang Kempe Wangpo, lived from 1820 to 1892. And there's one or two after him, but I think this is a good representation. His father was an official. His mother was a Mongolian princess. When he was very young, it was found that he could read books once and know their content and remember the content. When he was 20 years old, he received all of the monastic vows, which is something that usually took 12 years to attain. He became a doctor of science, philosophy, art, and religion. That's where the word Kenzei comes in. He had many distinguished students, as well as common people. He was an eclectic scholar and saint. His first vision was when he was 8. His primary vision was when he was 14. His life and contributions were prophesied, and he was given authority when he was 16 years old. And this as the result of going to a secluded grove on a quiet mountain. And there he received, according to his words, keys, initiations, and endowments from Padmasambhava. And with a glance, he says, Padmasambhava instructed him in many, many teachings. When he was 19, he was led to a treasure chest that was in, again, a stone repository. And in the repository, he received many sacred books, I think it was 3, and relics. When he was 28, he was again visited. This was in 1859. He received another book and a blessing. And from this book, he translated a work that's called The Precious Treasure of Concealed Teachings. It's said that he performed many miracles during his lifetime and was much revered by his people. Now, I thought it might be helpful and hopefully maybe even faith-promoting to extrapolate meanings and parallels between these two traditions. And to that end, I've scratched some things down, and if you have some comments as we go along, that's fine. And if not, I'll just kind of work away here. The Vajrayana, again, which means diamond path, and John the Revelator's precious stone is what I'd like to use to bring about. I'm not necessarily trying to simply point to parallels in traditions, but I'd like to aid in opening our appreciation of the ways or methods that we can find meaning, or in a more precise way, methods of liberation or salvation. There's something universal and appealing about diamond, or the stone of John the Revelator. It has been throughout history so. For example, we're all familiar with the Philosopher's Stone, and I'd like to read you just a little bit about that. The Philosopher's Stone is a symbol of great interest because it has given rise to many great thoughts and discoveries in the realms of philosophy and science. The vision implies it is the original substance, the ultimate principle of the world. According to the idea, all existing elements or phenomena are only variations of the same force or substance, which can be restored to its purity by reducing and dissolving the manifold qualities which have imposed themselves upon it through differentiation and subsequent specialization. Therefore, he who succeeds in penetrating to the purity of the undifferentiated primordial form has gained the key to the secret of the creative power. Now that comes out of an alchemical tract, but I think it's a nice adjunct to what we're talking about here today. And I had a few things I wanted to share with you about John the Revelator. And if I may, maybe I could just read to you Revelations 2 and 17 one more time. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but it says, "He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name written, which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it." And again in Peter it says, "To whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of man, but chosen of God and precious." And in Peter 2 and 6, "Wherefore also it is contained in the Scripture, Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded." I don't know, maybe I ought not drag Joseph Smith into this right now, but there's a nice statement, I'll read that one. "The angels do not reside on a planet like this earth, but they reside in the presence of God on a globe like a sea of glass and fire, where all things for their glory are manifest, past, present, future, and are continually before the Lord. The place where God resides is the great Urim and Thummim. This earth, in its sanctified and immortal state, will be made like unto crystal, and will be a Urim and Thummim to the inhabitants who dwell thereon, whereby all things pertaining to an inferior kingdom, or all kingdoms of a lower order, will be manifest to those who dwell on it, and this earth will be Christ. Then the white stone mentioned in Revelations 2 and 17 will become a Urim and Thummim to each individual who believes or receives one, whereby things pertaining to a higher order of kingdoms will be made known. And a white stone is given to each of those who come into the celestial kingdom, whereon a new name is written, which no man knoweth, save he that receiveth it. The new name is the key word." Now, breaking this down, I wanted to just make some parallels for us so we could just begin to think about this a little bit. But in Christian literature, many times we, and this is an assumption so you can challenge this carefully, many times all of the Gospels point towards the Gospel of the Kingdom. The Gospel of the Kingdom. So I'm going to put the Kingdom up here pretty high. Okay, the Kingdom of Heaven. And unlike some
theological position credibly. I'm suggesting this is not, nor can be reduced to a political social structure. And up in this realm is the reality of news, which is, you might say, glorified intelligence. It's the form of Plato, one up, you might say. It's here we have to deal with the idea of the holy or the sacred. Somewhere between here and there are these school laws that I was talking about, or these authorities, these people that are seminal or authoritative or given in the sense of authentic. Now, as we labor with historical reality, as we try to deal with alchemical or magical or religious events, or as I'm saying, as we try to deal with noetic events, such as visitations or visions or primary dreams, we have difficulty because many times we have a misunderstanding that deals with the idea that they have to be believed. So, beliefs or opinions or cultural mores or values or viewpoints, you might say, exist for the time being in this hierarchy, if we will. I'd like to maybe dissolve the hierarchy later if I can, but right now, it's something like this epistemological lab, beliefs, opinions, and so on. This exists here. And must not be mistaken for, noetic events must not be mistaken for these other kinds of phenomena, such as conditionings or cultural viewpoints. Now, in here is the thing I wanted to bring today, was along with this gift of an appreciation of this old culture that's lived right into the present day, I wanted to bring a couple of ideas in regards to John the Revelator's stone. So we have the Revelator up here, and we have these methodologies. And I wanted to compare these methodologies with the methodologies of the Vajrayana tradition and see if they couldn't help awaken one another a bit. In the methodologies of John the Revelator, we have to back up a bit and deal with the word repentance. In the word repentance, the Greek term is metanoia. Metanoia means a turning around of consciousness. It doesn't mean feeling sorrowful or making sackcloth of ashes. It means a tremendous revolutionary shift of consciousness and a total, you might say, total being or a total shift from one to another. And in that way, metanoia, or the sense of repentance, is this methodology that I'd like you to keep in mind. So, repentance becomes a method. And there's another idea I wanted to share with you about many times when we deal with the world of magic or religion, we're told we have to believe or we have to accept, and people mistakenly call that faith. That's not faith, that's belief. And here, I think a contribution by a German philosopher by the name of Fries, Jacob Fries, said that what's called for is a retroductive logic, meaning that we don't have to simply become dark and superstitious. In this day, we're not threatened with that. Many times, I think, as we try to bring together factions of, you might say, science that's based on logic and clear organizational structures and people from religion or consciousness, there's this apprehension that there may not be a way to come together. I think the truth allows us a way to come together through this reproductive logic. And it simply means this. Making assumptions and then building our structures on the assumptions, be they physical or metaphysical assumptions, he suggested what's necessary is a challenging of our presuppositions. So that every presupposition we begin to base our worldview on, or our view of reality, be it historical or scientific or philosophic, that begins to be questioned or challenged. So our presuppositions are challenged through this retroductive logic. Allowing ourselves to come to grips with, you might say, the ground that we have to deal with in terms of what's true or not true. Instead of simply assuming or accepting the assumption of things that are before us.
Now, this methodology
takes our situation, like for example, our school pot people, we can make, if this could be represent the noetic realm, again, it's geometric in the sense that it has laws, rules, things of that sort. And then if this could be the world of phenomena, and again, has its laws and rules, what have you, we can see the school pot or the teraton, or the mediator, as one who integrates the two worlds. As they integrate the two worlds, there has to be a sense of authenticity arise. As that authenticity arises, it begins to look many faceted. And again, we can call back to the idea of a stone and its many facetedness, and the fact that it seems intrinsically full of life. So, this becomes the focal point of absolute being, or the openness of being, with the world of appearance, or the phenomenal world. Okay, now that.
Not dualistic.
words, this kingdom is not dualistic, it's the parabolic teachings of Christ. Christ spoke in certain ways that allowed for not being caught in one form or another. Many times the Pharisee would come and ask him certain questions with the intention of having him, you might say, reduce his position to one particular form, be it political or religious. Each time he would say a parable, or he would act parabolically. For example, the woman's sin and casting the stone. Instead of saying this woman's wrong and such, instead of judgment in this time, it was a presentation of mercy and compassion. A presentation that found the crack, you might say, or the between space of what we might understand as reality if we were Pharisaical. Another good one is about the penny. The person that comes into the kingdom of heaven the last and still spake the same as the other. The breaking down of what's quantitative or qualitative. Breaking down our assumptions about space and time. Alright, now, in the Vajrayana, we've got a non-dualistic view. The diamond, again, the meaning begins to be this way. It's called supreme. This, the Vajra is called supreme emptiness. The path or the jnana is called supreme immutable bliss. And sometimes this is also called a burst of light or a stainless light. It's a way to describe the universe in the basic quality of mind. Clear, brilliant, indestructible, in many facets. And again, one of the Lamas says, the mind alone is the radiant jewel. Saying about as directly as they can the primacy of this viewpoint. The Vajrayana is the absence of all conceptual determinisms, determinations, and conditions, and is described as the realm of the uncreated and the unborn. Its methods are a little strange to us, and I'd like to review those just for a moment. There are six tantras. I know that you've heard that tantras are all about sex. You've heard about it all. It's just, unfortunately, not true. The six tantras start with Kriya Tantra, where the deity is visualized as outside of oneself. The next tantra is a quality. Again, you have to understand these are for characters or people of different levels of persuasion or different types of consciousness. The next one is Kriya Tantra, and it's where the deity is identified as identical with oneself. And then the Yoga Tantra is where the yoga power arises from an understanding of non-duality. Now that's the lower tantras, and I'd like to deal with the higher tantras. The higher tantras are called the father, mother, and non-dual tantras. The father tantra is the Mahayoga tantra. It has three siddhas, or virtues or powers. It has to do with internal channels and psychic centers. The techniques pertain largely to mind, but overlap into physical mudras or postures. Another aspect of the Mahayoga Tantra is the yogic techniques pertaining to the body specifically the breath. And the last one is techniques for the transmuting of the emotional focus into spiritual power. So that, in other words, when you're not denying your emotional energies, but you're transmuting them. The Anuttara Yoga is at the stage where the practitioner discovers the jewel in the ocean of samsara. So it's this second level. There's the Atta Yoga, the Anuttara Yoga, and the Maha Yoga. At this intermediate level is where the practitioner discovers the jewel or the diamond path. And here
here it's said in the literature that the deity appears of himself or itself. Now I have to borrow from another sect to, because I think it's the easiest way to clarify what kind of methodologies. Now remember, I'm trying to point to methodologies that are retroductive, not necessarily inductive or deductive. And these methodologies you have to go back to examining, if you would, like a depth psychologist, examining the constituents of our consciousness. So if we begin to examine these, in the Western terminology, we run into, like we've had people talk in terms of id, ego, superego, things like this. But here's a very sophisticated spiritual teaching who have devised numerous techniques and understandings and insights about the human condition, and they've divided it into six yogas. So the stage of the Anuttara Yoga, the stage that can provide for, you might say, fulfillment and understanding oneself and its attainment, like in the sense that John the Revelator suggested it, is in these yogas. And I'll just read through basically the six yogas. The first is the yoga of the inner fire, or dhumma breath. The second is the yoga of the illusory body. This is where an adept learns to see his own body and the body or objects of others as illusory. Third is the yoga of dreams. Now, we in the West think of dreaming in terms of you have a dream and then you interpret it. That's a misunderstanding in part of the Vajrayana tradition. They would say you have a dream and you learn how to observe your dream while you're sleeping and while you're waking, and you learn how to control your dreams while you're sleeping and while you're waking, and you learn how to integrate your sleeping and your waking state. That's what that yoga is all about. The fourth yoga, the yoga of clear light, it said, brings the adept or the meditator face to face with suchness or the oneness of reality. The fifth yoga is the yoga of the bardo. Bardo is a word that means the time between life and death. So it's the time that immediately after a person may die, where there are certain rites or rituals conducted to guide that person into their next life or into the next realm. It's also a word that implies the between space between one's thoughts, or space itself. We in the West many times fasten on objects. Our whole way of thinking is contained in manipulating objects. And so as we try to deal with objects, we think that that's what reality is all about, until finally we end up even treating ourselves and other people as objects. But according to this particular yoga, the Bardo Yoga, you can begin to appreciate reality only in sense of the, you might say, the figure ground, where the background or the space that an object is presented in is seen as alive. We many times think of the world as dead, or the space around us as dead, and only the objects, and all of those, many of those are not living either. And so we continue to reduce our potentiality as beings by seeing only in a very restricted, confined way, and only in terms of objects. But if we would take on even a more modern view in terms of theoretical physics, we can understand that that's not necessarily so, that reality does not perform that way. But anyway, the Vajrayana view was that these qualities worked in this manner, and the Bardo Yoga was one that opened a person's appreciation to it in an existential or experiential way. The last one is the yoga of conscious transference, and this is where one person could transfer to another person a blessedness or a state of being or a quality or an aspect that we have a hard time relating to, I guess. I think maybe I was reaching for an example in the West, and I think it might be where Elijah was leaving and Elisha asking for a double portion of his spirit. There's a good, clear declaration, I think, of conscious transference. Okay, now that's Anuttara Yoga. That's the second highest of the yogas in terms of the Vajrayana. The last and the culmination of their viewpoint is called the Ati Yoga. And it's, or another word for it is the Dzogchen teaching, which means absolute perfection. And this yoga starts with mind only. It's devoid of distinctions. It deals with the presuppositions we have about space and time. I think if if we begin to appreciate how fascinated we are on the movement of time and how much we've reduced it to a particular viewpoint, and after we have these kinds of appreciations, then we still don't know what to do with them. But this particular yoga went through a number of methodologies to free us from these prejudices that we have, or presuppositions that we have about time and space. It was culminated in a state that seemed spontaneously achieved, a state of unity. And it was the experience of the non-dual, unimpeded consciousness of things as they really are, a supreme, unexcelled enlightenment, and it abandons cognition and cognizer both. It also moves from objects to objectless awareness. Instead of knowing things, we have this knowing awareness, and the oneness of the knower, the known, and the knowing. So the Adi Yoga leads us out of our metaphysical and phenomenalistic presuppositions or speculations into a direct practice of reality that grounds us in being. We in today's world find ourselves with cultural dilemmas such as alienation and so on and so forth, that we find that we're alienated from values, or our values are come into the realm of politics, or into the realm of economics, or into the realm of some facet of power play, and we don't quite know what way to turn and to do. These yogas hearken us back to the ground of being, allow us to experience them directly, balance not just in terms of our culture or within our microcosm, but within the whole of cosmos, and as they say, into being itself. And also allows us to maybe, perhaps, enter the realm of authentic being. The 14th century Theraton Saint Longchenpa said this way: in the center of what may be said to be the very meaningfulness of reality, there resides intrinsically a cognitive property that maintains its inseparability from the ground as facticity, actuality, and responsiveness. While the ground has neither defects nor qualities, as a mere possibility for the emergence of distinct qualities, it is the life and like the life-fulfilling gem, because it may develop into anything one chooses, and hence it exists as the ultimate primeval source of all and everything. That concludes my comments today. I hope you enjoyed it. That was, we could discuss this treasure through our questions. I assumed that they would come up like they are now. In Joseph Smith's experience, as I was saying to this lady, I believe that we have someone who's experiencing noetic event that's totally transformed him in terms of what he was. Okay, his life details very much parallel the kinds that I was saying in terms of the Vajrayana. He had experiences of being awakened or visited by noetic beings. He had instruction. He was given certain kinds of keys or keywords. He was given certain kinds of understandings that were universal in character. He was capable of course, being a human being in many ways, as all of us are, but I think that the events in his life were the center of gravity of the events of his life were these noetic events. They shaped him and moved him. Yes?
In your training as a psychologist, are there any characteristics that I can answer that through the Vajrayana tradition. They say there are marks and signs of people of birth. They're not always necessarily manifest. They're not always actualized, but they're many times pointed to and appreciated in that way. Yeah. Well, as I'm suggesting in the, you might say, the grid that I put up, the authority arises out of the noetic intervention. It's grounded in being, not in phenomena, not in a political social structure, but beyond that structure, it's grounded in being. And that's why there's a sense of authority or authorship. I don't know. Yes. I don't have any idea. The only thing I was pointing to here was that kind of exchange did take place, and it seems to have taken place in Tibet on numerous occasions by people that weren't predisposed to have that kind of event happen. Is there what? My view is that you have to get it noetically. What? I don't know purely, but I would say that if you're talking in terms of authenticity, it would have to be grounded in noetic reality, from my viewpoint. Yes? Yes. He was one of the 49 Tertons recorded in the history of the Nyingmapa lineage. Their genealogy, you might say. That it's referred to in the Kanjo Tanya, which is the lexicon of total scriptures of the not only the Vajrayana Buddhists, but the Hinayanas and the Mahayana Buddhists. It's been recorded for some, in writing for some, I think, 15 centuries. A number of scholars, I think an excellent scholar is Herbert Gunther. A book I think that's really helpful would be Kindly Bent to Jesus by Lung Chim Pa, translated by Herbert Gunther. That'd be a good beginning point, I think. Okay. Thank you very much.